from one to some.
Well, I want to thank you all for coming, and the Institute for inviting me here. My talk is going to be about local quantum dynamics and information flow. And it's sort of a combination of some things that I've been working on with some other people over the last couple of years. And here are the other people. The first four are actually members of the, no kidding, the Kenyon College Quantum Information Group. Mike Westmullen is a mathematician down the road. Lee Kennard is an undergraduate who actually proved some of the theorems we'll see here. Michael Mathenson, a mathematician who was visiting with us this last year, is now at St. Mary's College in Oakland. Katarina Kristandl is a visitor in physics who's going out to Cal Poly to build quantum computers. And then also, another co-conspirator here is Reinhard Werner at Braunschweig. And all of these people have made contributions. This talk is the product of an unquiet conscience. When you do physics of information, when you do quantum information theory, you're forever saying things like, so, you know, the information kind of goes over here, or the information can't get from here to there. And you have this idea of information as this stuff that's kind of squirting around. And after speaking like that for a long time, I began to realize that I really wasn't quite sure about that. And even if you could get away speaking that way about classical information, what about quantum information? And so I started worrying about the heuristics for information that I had in my head, and in particular. I started worrying about the problem of locality, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. So this talk is a whole bunch of things trying to train our heuristic understanding about how information moves around in the quantum world. Okay, so what am I thinking about? What's the motivation? Well, here's the motivation. The idea is to think about the universe as kind of an information network. The universe is made out of a whole bunch of sort of distinct things divided into subsystems. And the subsystems interact and exchange information and talk to each other. But not every subsystem talks directly to every other subsystem. This system doesn't really interact directly with that system, and so information can't go from this system to that system except through the good offices of these intermediate systems, which transfer the information. So that's what we mean by locality, that not all subsystems exchange information directly. What I want to ask is, what does quantum mechanics say about the rules of this information web? And I want to ask, what does quantum mechanics say, therefore, about locality? What I'm really thinking about is cellular automata. It's sort of a hobby that I've played around with for a while. And a classical cellular automata model, they have a uniform grid of cells, maybe one-dimensional or two-dimensional, whatever you like. Each cell has a finite number of internal states. At each discrete time step, so you have discrete space and time, at each discrete time step, the cell states update according to a local rule. That is to say, in order to figure out how a particular cell updates, we don't need to know, in order to figure out the new state of this cell, we don't need to know the whole configuration of the grid. We only need to know about the configuration of a finite region called the neighborhood of this cell. And if you know what the state of the neighborhood is, you can figure out the new cell state. That's a cellular bond. Any local rule you come up with is okay. You say, oh, well, see, I have this the state of a five-cell neighborhood. I make up some function for the states of a one cell. That's fine. You made a cellular automaton rule. That's great. You're done. And the global update rule, if you look at how the whole configuration of the grid updates each time step, that global update rule can be either reversible or irreversible. There's some interesting reversible ones, but there's a whole bunch of irreversible ones, and all these things are possibilities. Of course, that's not what I'm really thinking. What I'm really thinking about is quantum cellular automata. And that's sort of like the same thing. You have a uniform grid of cells, but each cell is a quantum system, a qubit or something. And it's a little bit subtle, the definition is a little bit subtle. If I want to find the new state of some region here, I don't need to know the old state of the entire grid, but only the old state, you know, some density operator describing the state of some finite region of the grid. Now, I specified in terms of region because it might be that you sort of needed to know more to figure out the joint state of these two than you needed to figure out the individual state of this guy and the individual state of that guy. Because it's quantum mechanics. You have entanglement and things like that. So this is going to be a little bit trickier. And it turns out that not all local rules, not every rule you think up, can be woven together into a global cellular automaton. There are, you could think of a function from the state of three qubits to the state of one qubit. And it's not just a function, it's a CP map. It's good quantum dynamics. Okay? It doesn't mean that you can then make a grid where that rule is applying to every cell. For example, you could say, okay, take your center qubit and measure it. And if the result is zero, copy the state of the left-hand guy to the cell. And if the state is one, copy the state of the right-hand guy to the cell. So that sounds good. It's perfectly good dynamics. But if you try to apply that to two overlapping neighborhoods, you violate the no-cloning theorem really quick. So there's no global dynamics in which that can be the local dynamics of every cell. And it's a really interesting question about what local rules can be woven together into a global update rule. And we know something about that. I don't think we know everything. OK. It's also the case that if you look at the evolution of the entire grid, you can consider unitary cases where the whole grid evolves according to some unitary dynamics, or non-unitary cases where it's a more general kind of evolution. That's OK. Of course, what I'm really thinking about, causal structure in the universe. I have space-time here. Here I have a couple of space-like slices. And I consider the behavior of some quantum field. And the field variables in a bounded region at time t2 depend on the field variables only within some larger but still bounded region at t1. And they don't depend at all on these guys out here. These field variables commute with those guys. Okay? So the whole purpose of a cellular automata is to make discrete models that kind of look like physics. This is the physics we're making things look like. So this is really what I'm thinking about here, causal structure. Now, I'm not sure, but probably what some of you are thinking about is quantum causal histories, since that's a thing that happens around here. I think Lee Smolin and Fatim Markopoulou learned the earlier matinee performance. But anyway, here what you have is you have a partially ordered set of events, which gives you a kind of causal structure, wherever that causal structure comes from. And you have a matrix algebra in each event. And you have CP maps among the matrix algebras, which give you your dynamics. And I don't want to say much about this, except to say that in many ways, this is a more general structure that I'm considering here. Here, I'm going to have systems that persist in time that I consider at different times. And this is just a much more general, much more fundamental view of how things are going. And some of the results we have for this this other situation, this more specific situation, are also known in quantum causal history. So I mentioned this. But then quickly move on. Okay. So if you take one of those slices of space-time, or one of those configurations of a cellular automaton model or something, then you'll have something like this. A is some bounded system of interest. This is the system I'm considering, the system whose new state I want to figure out. And then C is the rest of the world out there, the stuff that's irrelevant. And then there's this intermediate system, B, which is the rest of the neighborhood. And just the intuition is, I need to know A and B to figure out the new A, but I don't need to know C, which is good, because generally this includes like other galaxies, things far away. So that's the intuition. From the point of view of information flow, though, that it's best not to think of them as being concentric, but to be arranged kind of in a chain. So in one time step, I mean, A interacts with B, B interacts with C, but in one time step, I'm thinking of discrete time, there's no information transfer from C to A. I don't have any information transfer going this way. So that's what I want to say. I'm going to need a definition pretty soon, right? OK. All right. So we're going to think of it this way rather than this way. So what do I mean by information flow? When does information flow from C to A? Well, let's unpack our intuition, which is all classical, of course, and see what that means. I want to say that information flows from C to A when the final state of A depends on the initial state of C. All right? And then information doesn't flow from C to A if the final state of A doesn't depend on the initial state of C. And I want to make this a general definition, so I want to consider all states of A and C. I'm going to have quantifiers over the states that no matter what this initial state of A and initial state of C might be, the final state of A doesn't depend on C. That's my definition of no information flow. Of course, this is a terrible definition. Because quantum mechanics, I've been talking about the state of A and the state of C, and like that's the whole story. But of course, the initial state of A and C is not determined by the initial states of A and C separately. You have things like quantum entanglement. So I'm going to have to be a little more careful. But before we're careful, let's see if there's going to be anything interesting in quantum mechanics. And we're going to consider the simplest classical case, two classical bits. And I'm going to have the famous controlled knot interaction between them. And this works this way. There's a controlled bit and a target bit. The controlled bit is unchanged by the interaction. The target bit is split if the controlled bit is 1. Otherwise, it's left alone. And what I notice here is that first of all, the operation is reversible. I just apply it twice, in fact. I get the original state back. But the second thing I want to notice is that the final state of the target does depend on the initial state of the control bit. So information does flow from the control bit to the target bit. But the final state of the control bit is the same as it was to begin with. So it doesn't depend on the initial state of the target bit. And so information doesn't flow from target to control. And so the moral of the story here is that the classical C-knot gate has one-way information flow. Information doesn't flow from this direction, from the control to the target, and not vice versa. Things are different in quantum mechanics. If we just turn the bits into qubits, and we just sort of fill in the reversible map by linearity into a unitary map that expresses some interaction between C and T, then we can ask, is there one-way information flow here? And the answer is no. And the answer is kind of cute, because if you look at how this thing behaves on a conjugate basis, 0 plus 1, 0 minus 1, then it actually is a CNOT in the conjugate basis, except the role of control and target changes. And so in the conjugate basis, we have to think of the information flow going in the other direction. So the information flow is two-way in the CNOT. All right. So there's no one-way information flow. In fact, no unitary interaction between two systems leads to one-way information flow between the quantum systems. There's a kind of action and reaction principle in information in interacting quantum systems. And of course, this is the secret of the universe, because I can think of this as kind of a prototype of a quantum measurement. And C is my system of interest, and T is my measuring apparatus. And I would love to design a measurement where the information flow is all from the system of interest to the measurement apparatus, and no information went the other way to disturb the system. That would be great. But unfortunately, interactions in the quantum world don't do that. We'd like to have information flow this only so that we don't disturb the system, but any unitary interaction between my system of interest and my apparatus can make information flow either way. And so we have complementarity. And that, you know, that has some claim to being the secret of the universe. So I was only joking a little bit. Okay. So non-unitary quantum operations, on the other hand, can have one-way information flow. For example, if I made a measurement on the control bit and then use the result to rotate T or not, then that would be one-way information flow, because the final state of the control bit wouldn't depend on the initial state of the target. Okay. This is old hat to probably everybody in the room. So let me do this in these transparencies in a minute and a half. Quantum dynamics for isolated systems described by a unitary operator. Unitary operators take pure states to pure states, mixed states to mixed states. For open systems, the general quantum evolution we'll consider is a map on density operators. Pure states can evolve to mixed states. Mixed states can evolve to pure states. And those maps need to be linear, trace preserving, and completely positive, the CP maps. Of course, the CP maps really aren't anything new, because every CP map can be thought of as being a kind of unitary evolution. What you can do is you can append an environment in some fixed state. So this is not going to be like an input system. It's going to be a system that's required to be in some fixed state. And then I have unitary dynamics, and I trace over the environment, and I can cook up an environment and an interaction such that the net result of this is whatever CP map that I like. So the overall interaction is unitary. My environment is restricted to a standard state at the beginning, and I throw it away afterwards. I can only think of things in that way. So that means that a box like this, which I call it all gray, that's a CP map, can really be thought of as a box like this, where I have an input, and all my boxes will be going from left to right, where I have an input of a standard state here, and I input Q here. They have a unitary interaction, nice blue unitary interaction, and then I throw the environment away. So every one of these could be modeled that way. Okay. Finally, at the risk of extending my minute and a half, we can have CP maps between states of different systems. For example, we can have a CP map that takes the state of a large system to the state of the subsystem. The partial trace is such a map, for example. You feed in the state of a composite system, and you get out a state of one of the subsystems. So you can make CP maps like this. And you can also make CP maps going the other way, where the final system is larger than the initial system. You can do any kind of thing like that. Okay. Now, it's time to define what I mean by locality, or by no information flow from one system to another. And in my definition, I want to consider three systems, because there's the system from, the system to, and there may be something else around. And so I have three systems, A, B, and C, and I'm going to have some global evolution of this system described by a global CP map on the states of this tripartite system. And so my first definition of locality, locality being that C, there's no information flow from C to A, my first definition of locality for A's evolution is simply that there's a map such that I can figure out the final A state knowing only the initial state of AB. That there exists a map from the AB state to the A state, a CP map that does the job of this guy. Okay? Simply that is a mathematical thing. I don't need anything more than a description of this partial state. The second definition is to try to rescue the classical definition, where I ascribe definite states to the individual systems, the classical discussion, by just focusing on the case where that can really happen. So I suppose in this definition that A, B, and C are initially in a product pure state, the alpha of A, beta of B, gamma of C, and then I require that the final state of A, which might be a mixed state, doesn't depend on which gamma I have here. But I'm only considering things for triple product states here. Because those are the cases where it makes sense to say, oh yeah, the state of A is this, the state of B is this, the state of C is that. Okay? Then there's a third definition of locality, which is that suppose you're given any state at all, including an entangled state, then do the following two things. First, monkey around with C in some fashion. You choose. And then execute the evolution and require that the final state of A doesn't depend on your choice of operation performed from the C. Okay? Now, in these, I sort of think of this as being the gold standard definition. I think that's the really good one. This one is really handy inside calculus, inside proofs and stuff. And this one is the one that I sort of wind up stating a lot. But luckily, they're all good ones. That's a good thing. Okay. Yeah?
So these definitions allow that you could have two systems A and B. Neither of them depends on C.
It could be.
But the joint system AB does depend on C.
It could happen. All right, certain. So for example, measure C, and then use that measure method to determine what Bell state to prepare A and B.
Yeah.
Yep. That would be no information transfer from C to A, but of course, that's not the whole story, clearly.
Right.
But clearly, anything you do to C at the beginning wouldn't show up in something I did to A at the end.
Yeah,
so that's what I mean. Okay, so I want to consider situations which are globally unitary. In other words, I want the global evolution of the whole system to be unitary, because that example I just gave you wasn't. And then I want to also have no information transfer from C to A. And the first question is, can I have both things, global unitarity and no information transfer from C to A? The answer is, well, yeah, obviously. One thing I could do is I could just make sure that A or C were isolated. I could just have A do its own thing and then B and C interact. Or I could have A and B interact and C do its own thing and they never connect to each other. So, okay, that's fine. I could also have, imagine that B was a composite system and A and C interacted with different parts of B, but still there's a wall between them. There's a wall that's never bridged. You know, there's a place I can say, oh, there's no interaction between this side and that side. So these are trivial cases. Here's something a little more interesting. Here we have an interaction of A and B, unitary interaction, followed by a unitary interaction of B and C, And in this case, we can have information transfer from A to C, but not from C to A. Isn't that one-way information transfer? Yes, but I've got a third system standing around, so that's OK. So that's OK. I can have information go that way. But that's not good. That's bad. So information won't go that way. So all the previous examples can be cast in this form. Because if one of the systems is isolated, then that commutes with the other interaction. Or if B is in two parts, basically the two interactions commute with each other, so I can always write it in this order in the previous examples. But this includes a lot of stuff which aren't in the previous examples. In fact, it includes all of the examples. That all it's a theorem that every unitary interaction which has no information transfer from C to A, every one of them is of this form, can be decomposed in this way. Let's say it a little more carefully. So suppose the system ABC evolves by a unitary interaction such that no information transfer is possible from C to A by any definition you want. Then this unitary can be decomposed as an interaction between A and B, composed with an interaction between B and C, both of them being unitary. Okay? This is the only way it can happen. You can hide the system C from the system A. And they both are interacting with B, but you can hide C from A, but the only place you can hide it is in the future. Okay? That's sort of a comic book way of saying it. Okay, so that's a nice result. That sort of tells us a lot of things. A consequence of this result is actually a theorem that was previously known, which is the question, suppose you have a general CP map on A and C such that no information is transferred from C to A. Then there is a unitary representation of that CP map of this form, where there's one environment for both systems. A interacts with the environment, and then A is done with the environment, A is finished with the environment, before B ever gets to it, or before C ever gets to it. Okay? That A completes its interaction before C does. Is this really how it happens? No, I don't know, but what I'm saying is that it could have happened that way. There is a decomposition of this form. And in fact, Daniel certainly will recognize this result, because this is a paper called Semi-Causal Operations or Semi-Localizable. Daniel is in the audience here. Conjecture by Beckman et al. And John Preskill, and who else was doing that? Okay. So this was an earlier thing. It's not quite our theorem. E, for example, is not really an input. It's something that's fixed it in form. And furthermore, I don't think that two system theorems really capture everything we want to say about locality because of the role of the neighborhood. That there's a system, there's some surroundings that do matter, and there's surroundings that don't. So I think that locality is essentially a three-system idea. Okay, well, can we do it in general? Suppose that the global evolution is not unitary, but it's just a general CP map, and no information is transferred from C to A. Does it follow that there's always a decomposition of that map as follows? A CP map on AB followed by a CP map on BC. And the answer is no. And in fact, we already mentioned an example. Remember the example, instead of doing C not, if I measured a basis on one qubit, and then use that basis to do conditional dynamics on the other one? Well, just forget about B. If A is the one that I measure, and C is the one that I act on, then it doesn't work. However, something pretty cool does work. And that's that if I have such a map, general map no information transfer from C to A, then I can come up with a unitary representation for that map of the following form. First, A, B, and interact with the environment. And then B and C interact with the same environment. Now, this first part is a CP map on AB. But the second part isn't a CP map on BC because your environment's not pristine. Your environment has a state which might be dependent, for example, on your previous state of B. Certainly depends on your state of A. So the point is that if you have any CP map, global CP map with one-way information transfer in this three-system situation, you can come up with a unitary representation that looks like this. Once again, the way that mathematically, the way that C is hidden from A is that C doesn't enter the picture until A has stopped talking to anybody. That's the only way it can happen, or something which is mathematically equivalent. I say it's the only way it can happen. Whatever happens can be thought of in this way. Okay. So now I want to now I want to turn back a little bit and start thinking about cellular automata. I want to go back and I want to start thinking about the connections between classical ideas of locality and quantum ideas of locality, connections and distinctions. And I want to, first of all, talk about properties of quantum cellular automata, and then to talk about something a little more general. So when I think about the dynamics of a cellular automata model, there are sort of three levels. The first is sort of the local cell rule, where I have a neighborhood, and that the state of that neighborhood determines the state of the cell. And then there's sort of an intermediate level, where to figure out the state of a block of cells, I look at the neighborhood for that block, and that determines the final state there. And then I can consider the whole grid, the global update rule, which is the state of the whole grid updates to the state of the grid afterwards. Okay, so I want to sort of think about connections between these, and the connections for classical CAs are trivial. I mean, they're obvious. So, for example, the neighborhood for the block is just a union of the neighborhoods for the cell, the cells in the block. To figure out what the state of this guy is, I need to know the state of that guy, and of that guy. And it suffices, therefore, to know this neighborhood, and this neighborhood. And so I just need the union of the blocks to get the block of the cell neighborhoods over the block to get this. So that's pretty.
It's
in stochastic cellular automata, you have to talk about noise, and you have to say something about how or whether the noise is correlated among cells. So you have a noisy input. Maybe every cell sees an independent noise source, in which case this is right. Maybe there's something more complicated going on, in which case it's hard to say.
This doesn't work necessarily.
I bet I could come up with a counterexample in that case. But in the case of independent noise, it still works. another thing is that, I'm talking deterministic cellular automata. The global update rule is completely determined by the local rule. I mean, if I know the local rule here, and the local rule here, and the local rule here, then I know how the global thing updates. Finally, and this is hard to this is so obvious it's hard to even say. If all the local rules are the same, if I have the same local rule everywhere, and I wanted to figure out, I had a grid configuration, and I wanted to figure out the new state for a shifted version of that grid configuration, I could do good either way. I could either shift the grid, then apply the dynamics, or I could apply the dynamics and then shift the grid. Okay? Those things would be the same. And so all these three facts I may need to know about boundary conditions here. Let's assume I solve periodic boundary conditions. All of these are pretty obvious for classical cellular automata, and none of them is true in general for quantum cellular automata. For example, let's suppose that my global update rule is as follows. Look at this. Take qubit number 4. And it's qubit number 4. This is the global update rule. Take qubit number 4, measure it. If it's 0, create the global cap, say, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1. If you get the other result, then make 0, 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1. Now, how does that look for one cell? For one cell, it says, whatever your state is, make it completely mixed. Make it the identity. That's local. Okay? In fact, it's local with a zero cell neighborhood. However, even to know the new state of two cells, certainly to know the global state, I'm going to have to know the global state is not translation invariant. The global rule is not translation invariant because it depends on picking out number 4. And so on.
All the local rules
have
neighborhood 0.
All the local rules have neighborhood 0, but I don't think
that's the case for
blocks. I don't think that's right. And the reason is that suppose cell number 4 happens to be in 0 plus 1. No, it works. Maybe blocks it's still 0, but the global one is not right. I can make the other one fail by a similar example, where this applies only to certain regions. Okay? Where that applies to this is the first 6 qubits are like that. And the next 6, you look at number 8. The next 6, you look at number 15, and so on. These are not true in general for general quantum cellular automata. But the good news is that something like them is true if you have reversible quantum cellular automata, namely the global map is unitary. If the global evolution of the thing is unitary, then it turns out that the neighborhood of the block is just the union of the cell neighborhoods. It turns out that the global unitary is completely determined up to a global phase. By the local rules. If you tell me all the local rules, I can reconstruct the global evolution up to a local phase, provided that the global evolution is unitary. And furthermore, if all local rules are the same, if it's the same rule applied at every point in this one-dimensional grid here, then this global unitary commutes with the shift operator. And so I can either apply the evolution and then shift, or shift and then apply the evolution. It's just the same. All these things are good when there's global unitarity, and none of them are any good if you don't have global unitarity. I don't want to make any claims about that, but it's a fact. Some of these, for instance, this middle one, were known. This actually should be 2003. I have a reference at the end. Hawkins, Martha Kulu, and someone else who is neither Hawkins nor Martha Kulu, a paper on quantum causal histories. And then we derived it in this more limited context. Lee Kinnard, my undergraduate, pretty good, proved all these theorems last summer. Let's change focus again. Suppose I have a classical map, and I can somehow identify the corresponding quantum map. And the classical map has some locality conditions. What would that tell me about the locality conditions of the quantum map? So in particular, suppose I have a global update rule for n discrete variables. N is 4 in this picture, but that could be any number. So that the final state is some function of the initial state. And this map is reversible in the sense that this is one-to-one and onto. So there's an inverse map. OK? That's the classical reversible kind of system. They include interactions or whatever. Now, I could take that, and I could make a corresponding quantum mechanical situation where my systems are quantum mechanical versions of these classical variables. And I just consider a product basis. And basically, what I do is I apply the reversible map to the product basis vectors. And then I say, fill it in by linearity. And that works. And you get a unitary dynamics here. And that's basis vectors to basis vectors. So this is sort of the quantum version of this classical situation. But of course, lots of other things can happen. You have superposition states and entanglement and all of the things like that. So my question here is, how do the classical locality properties of F determine the quantum locality properties of U, F, of the unitary version of F? And so here's the here's a little bit careful, a more careful setup to a specific problem. So what I do is imagine I have a one-dimensional array of n finite classical variables. They don't all have to be the same, but there are n of them. And then my map is not only reversible, but it has the following locality conditions. That classical information can only flow to nearest neighbors. Okay? That classically, the state of this guy might influence the state of this guy or the state of this guy, but does not influence any of these guys. Okay? And I say that's true for the whole array. They only influence their nearest neighbors. Only information flow classically between nearest neighbors. And I'm also going to assume, so that's F, I'm also going to assume that the inverse rule also only exchanges information between nearest neighbors. Okay? So when I go backwards, it only exchanges information between nearest neighbors. This is a non-trivial requirement. Okay? Because even if the forward rule was beautifully reversible and only involved nearest neighbors, that's no guarantee that the inverse path only involves nearest neighbors. In fact, reversibility in classical cellular automata is a really interesting and deep issue. If you have a reversible automata that has a neighborhood of a given size, there's no computable upper bound to the size of the neighborhood of the inverse automata. In fact, the question of there's no effective procedure for computing whether an automaton is invertible, is reversible, whether there exists one, because the inverse map might have arbitrarily large neighborhoods. There are examples where the inverse map has a neighborhood that is as big as you like. There are ways of constructing such examples, and then also there are ways of mapping this onto, you know, the usual kind of uncomputable things. So this is a strong requirement, but that's okay. This does not necessarily mean, these don't necessarily mean cellular automata. This is the kind of system I want to consider. I have nearest neighbor information transfer both in the forward and reverse directions. Okay. Now. Okay, so this is a non-trivial property for a reversible classical cellular automata. So here's the question. I have my unitary map for the corresponding quantum systems. And my question is the global evolution local enough, does the classical locality make this local enough to prevent information transfer from C down to A, where A is some distance down the array? Okay? Is there a quantum locality induced by the classical locality? So we could ask this question, for example, for n equal to 3. Now classically, no information can flow from C to A. But quantum mechanically, it turns out that that it can happen that even though classically no information can go from C to A, quantum mechanically information can go from C to A. And an easy example of that is the Toffoli gate, where C and A both control some operation of B. And classically, yeah, nothing gets from A to here, but nothing gets from A to here. But it's not hard to come up with to demonstrate that quantum mechanically, some operation here can affect the final state here. So N equal to 3, C and A are not far enough apart in general. On the other hand, for N equal to 5, if I have this classical map from 5 systems on 5 systems that is reversible and has only nearest neighbor information transfer, both in the forward and reverse directions, then the top system can't influence the bottom system when I quantize it. Okay? No information flow can go from C to A, even in the quantum case. Yeah?
N equals 4.
Right, N equals 4. Exactly. Okay. For N equal to 4, we have proved this for qubits. But the technique we use to prove it for qubits is inappropriate for proving it in general. So we don't know the answer. There's probably a slick way to do this with operator algorithms, but my student and I didn't discover it. So I can't tell you the answer to that. So this is homework exercise. So it's possible that classical map does induce a kind of quantum locality, but you might have to go further. You might have to have bigger neighborhoods. You might have to have bigger neighborhoods to get locality. Okay. Now I want to turn to the thing I've been working on most recently. And that is dissecting C-naught. C-naught, we tend to think of C-naught as a unit. It's a primitive. We just use it when we need to. But once again, my conscience is unquiet about that. I know that there's something interesting going on inside of C-naught. I know in the quantum mechanical C-naught, there's information flow in both directions. So how does that happen? What's going on? Could I take apart C-naught and see how it works? Okay? Can I model this two-way information flow in an explicit way? I want to say, what's the structure of the information flow in C-naught? So my model is, the model I want to look at is simple information exchange, which I say is this. Okay, I got my two qubits, all right? And what happens is, I have some kind of CP map here, and they produce some extra stuff, and the extra stuff gets exchanged, and maybe these lines in here aren't even qubits anyway. And then there's another CP map here, and then I want to say, I've got two-way information exchange, right? I've got information going that way, Can I build C-naught in this way, using maybe irreversible parts, but can I do it? That's my question. Now notice that I can build any classical gate in this way. Because all I have to do is over here, I make a copy of this guy and send it here, and a copy of this guy and send it over here, and then everybody knows what to do. Okay? I think we worked it out after the talk this afternoon, but that's true even if there's a stochastic kind of interaction. Okay, so any classical gate can be done this way. Of course, I worry a little bit because the way I know how to do it is to just make copies of things, and I know that's a no-no quantum mechanical. So the question is, can C-naught be modeled by local CP maps in this simple information exchange? And the answer is no, it can't. And I can give you the idea of the argument really simply. Okay? This is the control bit. This is the target bit in the standard cases. Let's set the control bit to 0. That means that whatever quantum state the target bit is in, it comes out in the same quantum state. That means that if I look at the action of this map, I get some kind of terrible state here, maybe. But whatever it is, I can error correct it, because I can get the same thing back at the end. since this in here is something that I can error correct, that means no information about what the state is can reside in this guy. So this operation is such that whatever this is, it doesn't depend on this. But if that's the case, when I look at it in the conjugate basis, it can't possibly work. Because in the conjugate basis, this is the control bit. And so information had better be able to flow this way. But sorry, it doesn't work. It doesn't happen. So CNOT is impossible to build with this information flow switch. That's good. Okay. So, yeah?
So, I guess I'm not completely convinced by that argument, because if they share HPR cards
Next slide. Right. Let me give you the general theorem here, by the way, which is due to Michael Nathanson in our group. And that is that if you have a unitary interaction of two qubits, which is entangling in the sense that if you put in a product state, it's possible for some input product states there's an entangled output state. No such gate can be modeled by local CP maps and simple information exchange. Yes.
So when we're modeling this thing in the classical case, we're just making copies, right?
Yeah, that's right.
But then,
so we might have been able to do something else. That was just what I thought.
Yeah, but then the wire that goes up has information about the wire that comes in front, right?
Hmm? The wire that's going up knows what this guy is.
Yeah.
And so does this guy.
Yeah.
Both of them know. Yeah.
So that holds even when the top wire is zero.
Well, in the classical case, yes. Because there's no problem with having the state of this guy located here and here. And so when these guys get together, all the information that's input into the gate will be present at this map, and therefore we can figure out easily what to do, what to make the top system to be. And the same thing is true down below, classically.
No. What I'm saying is that this argument that the down wire should be independent of the wire that goes up. Necessarily,
yeah,
it seems to fail.
Yeah, you're right. It depends on quantum error correction.
It depends on quantum error correction. The fact that the C naught, if this is zero, which does not affect what operation is here, then whatever operation this does to the bit can be exactly corrected, no matter what pure state is input. And so I can do perfect quantum error correction on whatever state emerges from here. And it's a theorem that if that's the case, then essentially this state cannot depend on, the state of this diagonal wire cannot depend on the input state of the lower wire. Okay. Of course, you can make C naught in things like this. For example, if you did your information transfer this way, where first you went this way and then you went back that way, you could do it. In fact, what you do is you just send this guy over here, do C naught, bring it back. Okay? So that works. And then we could do what Daniel suggested. We could start out with an EPR pair, and then we could in between them, and then we could do the C naughts, exchange them, this is more C naughts. And in fact, I hope you don't mind, I made a loop here because I wound up with exactly the same entangled state that I started with. I didn't use it up. So I can do this. So here's the question. What's the essential difference between this information flow pattern and these information flow patterns? Because I can make a C naught this way, or I can make a C naught that way, but I can't make it that way. So what's the heuristic I need to be able to look at this and say, oh, yeah, well, that's not going to be good enough. Oh, yeah, okay, sure. What's the deep idea here? I don't know. We're at the end of the talk, so it's my time to ask a big question. Maybe it's a very little question. All right, well, thinking of a C naught, can't be that complicated. Okay. So what do we say? We said, well, the unitary interactions always allow information flow in both ways, But this is not, as we said, just saw, that's not just a simple information exchange. So the C0 is not equal to one of these guys. Okay? Even though this guy has information flow in both directions, there's more to C0 than that. Secondly, in order to prevent information transfer from C to A, we must somehow hide C from A. And in the interaction, and in the globally unitary case, the only way to do that is to sort of put C in the causal future of A. You can't get messages from the future in some sense. The obvious relationship between local and global dynamics hold for globally unitary quantum cellular automata, but not in general. And finally, locality in a reversible CA rule yields locality with a bigger neighborhood for a corresponding unitary quantum cellular automata rule, which is what was really, I was really talking about with those, with the phi system, four system, three system example. Okay, so here's some things to read. Some of them are good. And I thank you. And we'll stand for questions. Yeah.
I have a bunch of questions, so maybe I'll ask one and then.
Okay.
For the last thing.
Yeah.
So clearly the lower left, you could do any unitary that way.
Yes, obviously. Mm-hmm.
But it's not so obvious for the lower right picture.
I don't know. Do you?
No,
okay.
Right.
Debbie? Yeah? I mean, okay. Well, all right. That, we ought to be able to answer that, right?
Can you do the swap with this one?
Maybe? Oh, of course you can do the swap.
Yeah,
that
swap.
No,
just,
okay.
So that's not too. Yeah. Swap's easy. Because if you just do swaps here, then. I don't know if you get it back. Let's see. That swaps to that. Yeah, okay. Right.
Right.
Yeah,
square root of swap.
Nope. Square root of swap. Let's see. Does that takes basis? That takes product states into the entangled states, doesn't it? It can.
Yeah.
Swap doesn't, but the square root of swap probably does. And if so, it falls under the Nathan's result. So. Which is very pretty. And actually, the Nathanson result, I've set it too generally. I apologize. That is for qubits. We don't know the general result. But for qubits, the trick is exactly the same, plus some knowledge about the geometry of qubit gates, which Michael knows because he works with Mary Beth and Sky and those people, they know all about the geometry of these things. So.
Yes. A lot of the comparisons you make between quantum and classical, we have deterministic classical.
Yes, that's right.
And then we have stochastic classical.
Then you have to talk about what stochastic model you're talking about, because in stochastic quantum cellular automata, it's really crucial. If you have, you typically think of the update rule as being, you know, your function is a function of the neighborhood state and some random bits. The question is, do next door neighbor cells get the same random bits? Do they get correlated random bits? Or do they get completely independent random bits? And that's very important. Okay, because for example, if they're correlated, then the local rule, local cell update rule, doesn't tell you how they're correlated, and so that won't tell you the global rule. The local rule won't influence the global rule. So in order to get from the local rule to the global rule, you have to make statements about how the noise is correlated. So there are a lot of issues there that we haven't sorted out. But we think, as of this afternoon, that if we try to do this for some sort of stochastic interaction of two systems, then any stochastic interaction could also be done here, where the noise is generated locally as needed. Yes.
I was lured to this talk because your abstract says something about causal structure. You had one slide.
I think what the talk is about is what do we mean by the causal structure of the world, and if there is such a causal structure, well, what does that imply about interaction in some simplified discretized models? Okay. Now, does this equip you to somehow derive where the light cones go? No, I don't think so. But maybe. I don't know. I don't know how applicable all of these ideas are to serious attempts to find that, like quantum puzzle histories. But for example, things like global dynamics determining global dynamics in some kind of globally reversible situation, those ideas map straight onto quantum causal histories. Those are also true there, and so I think that's an important connection to what's really a serious fundamental theory. Yeah.
One thing I picked up was that the limiting speed in the quantum theory could be larger than in classical theory.
That's right, because information can sort of the neighborhoods are larger.
Right.
So if you have a reversible classical automaton and you say, oh, well, information could go this fast, if it's quantum mechanical, the information can possibly go at least twice as fast. So that's kind of interesting.
I have one question about the clarification about this local rule, global rule, where you say, and this intermediate neighborhood when you went to the quantum case. And you gave this counter example where you sort of said, okay, box not if I just measure one and then I prepare this or that sheet, let's say.
Yes.
Why would I call that rule, this global rule, why would I call that a Sella Hotmar?
Oh, well, the
because that seems to be very general, like any CP map.
Because to determine the new state of any bounded region, I only need to determine the old state in a bounded region. In fact, except for the whole map, that original example, I actually could look at nothing. That's local. It's sort of trivially local, but I could fix it up to be a little more interesting. The point is that would satisfy all the axes for a general quantum set of automata. Although it's crazy, it's cuckoo. It's also that particular one is not translation invariant, the global rule. So I'd have to think about whether translation invariance gives you more. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you could just measure all the qubits and then take
the parity. That would work. Jonathan, you were.
Maybe.
I'll ask you.
I'll ask you anyway. Can the bottom right be converted to that, to the one on the left? It's almost like you're teleporting the qubit back and forth, no? Or is that not?
I don't know, is it teleportation? What happens is you have 0, 0 plus 1, 1 here, and then to do a C naught in this direction, you do C naught, C naught, C naught, C naught, and you get back 5 plus.
Right.
And so is that teleportation?
It might be a coherent.
I don't know what it is. It works in this way. So I mean, there's no measurement involved, but there's really no measurement involved because you get back this coherence, this state in phi plus. But maybe that's okay. Maybe it's related to teleportation. Almost everything appears to be. Yeah.
So one criticism of a lot of the work on quantifying entanglements is at the end you get this number that quantifies entanglements and so what. And so here at the end you end up with some quantification of local flow and so what. And a possible answer would be, well, by thinking in terms of conceptualizing in terms of information flow, you can maybe go back and derive quantum theory, or you can couch deep principles in terms of information flow and make those deep principles do some work for you. Do you have any ideas in that direction?
I have tried to steer clear from quantifying information flow and simply saying, does it or doesn't it?
Okay, so
the 0-1 concept. Yeah, the 0-1 concept, right. So that's a certain quantification. I think my present thinking is that if I understood this example a lot better, then that might really tell me something, because if I just say, oh yeah, well, these things interact and information flow goes both ways, then I might write down something like this. But somehow there's a little bit more. That this unitary interaction is a little bit more than just the two-way information flow. There's something else, and I don't know quite how to express it. It seems to me to be a potentially fruitful kind of question. It might teach you something about what this means in principle. Now, I don't know how to build quantum mechanics out of these ideas, but I don't even know whether that's a reasonable hope. Even the kind of sort of quasi pseudo reasonable hope that you cling to. So.
So if you have a global unitary update rule.
Yes.
So this is going back to the thing about the classical. Yeah, the classical reversible rule, where the information was local.
Yes, that's right.
The inverse, but the inverse didn't have to be.
Yeah. So you have the inverse is local. The inverse of a reversible cellular automaton is a cellular automaton. However, the neighborhood size for the inverse might be very much larger. Now, if these systems are not individual cells in your automaton, but enormous blocks of cells, then even if a neighborhood rule has a big neighborhood, if that's like smaller than my block, then it's still a nearest neighbor in reverse. Because I can think of a big block as being sort of a supercell and a super automaton. It's still finite number of states, right? Yeah. And so really, by allowing these things to be big blocks, I actually can do any reversible cellular automaton. It's just that I can't tell you how big the blocks have to be.
That actually wasn't my question. So I just wanted to know if this property, that the inverse could have the unbounded neighborhood, if that holds true, if you have in the quantum case, if you have a global unitary, what about the inverse neighborhood?
Okay, if you have a globally unitary quantum cellular automaton, such that the forward map is a nearest neighbor map. Then I believe actually the inverse map is also nearest neighbor. It is also nearest neighbor. And the reason is that the cellular automaton, the size of the neighborhood, the information flow can have very long reach in the unitary case that it can't have in the classical case. It can have as long a reach as the size of the neighborhood in the inverse map, and longer even. So what that means is that if you have a forward rule that has a really small neighborhood, and the reverse rule has a big neighborhood, and you look at the unitary rule, it's going to have a really gigantic neighborhood. So it has to be at least as big as the inverse map. So if you have a nearest neighbor forward classical cellular automaton in one dimension, and then Werner, and with a little bit of seasoning from me, proved that the inverse must be nearest neighbor as well. We have a sort of structure theory.
Sorry, that's true for general one, or just one that's a classical derived from classical function?
That's true in general for globally unitary one-dimensional quantum cellular automata. I put up the paper by us. It's on QP8 Funky H. One of the reasons it's still on Funky H, and rather than have a real reference, is that we have learned that there are repairs to be made in the paper. All the one-dimensional results, however, are completely reliable. The two-dimensional results are, they need repair. So we're trying to write a revision. Anyway. Yeah, Lucy.
So a naive interpretation of the n equals 3 case would be that you can get subliminal signals at first. But the example you gave was a topic gate where
sure. You
actually have a three-way interaction. And presumably there's no.
You have a 3? Yeah, that's right. But it's a 3? Yeah, let's see.
So presumably there isn't any other signal.
I mean, so you have the light, but you have things coming in from opposite sides of the light. That's the topic gate, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. But you get all the way from here over to here in one step. Right. You can get outside the classical light cone a certain distance, not arbitrarily, but a certain distance in these quantum sweep models. Yes?
So the classical light cone, can you give any operational view? Is the classical light cone the one that you would discover by just sending in appropriate basis states when you do that?
Correct.
Right.
And so you'd have to do something else
to see the
quantum
lights.
Right. Anybody who wants to leave has my permission, but I'm willing to stay here all evening.
So Lucy and I are operating now.
Okay. All right.
Okay, but this is maybe my last one. there's a recent paper by by Arrow and Tor, showing that the unitary with the forward communication capacity is greater than different than backward communication capacity. And I think actually they probably could be a lot bigger. Yeah, a lot bigger.
Cool.
Okay, so you didn't know about that.
I didn't know about that. No. That's very cool. All right. You're not sure if it's I'll check, see if there's something up about it.
Yeah,
okay, all right. That would be excellent.
It's not obviously related.
They can't just have one being zero and the other one being non-zero.
Sure.
Right. But right.
So actually, the question.
When you go to the next stage where you try to quantify this stuff, that would be a really important question.
And given one of the very first things you said, this says something about measurement.
You have to modify
that statement, right?
That's a really interesting question, isn't it? What does their thing say about getting a lot of information without making much of a surface? Cool. Okay, we have to look at that. Okay.
No further questions.
A pause over the other direction.